Well, my thoughts this morning are kind of traveling down the same line that they've been all week. This week, our family had the opportunity to visit the Ark Encounter. How many of you have been there already? Okay, so a number of you have already been. Several people asked me what impressed me most about the Ark. And it's maybe a little hard to know for sure what impressed me most. Those of you that have been there know what I mean when you stand in front of it and just are amazed at the immensity of the structure. It's such a big boat. It's huge. I was amazed and mind-boggled to think about how much preparation it took, not just to build the ark, but to prepare the food for all of those animals and for the people too. I was amazed to think about the technology that likely existed, some of the concepts of things that they may have used for ventilation and waste control, and I don't know. I mean, some of that, of course, is speculation, but I was amazed at how much technology perhaps went into it, much more than what that I would have just thought offhand. The scale of the destruction also just struck me anew. The whole earth was destroyed. This was the deadliest event in the history of mankind. Try to think today, all the people out there, pick 8 people out of the world and destroy the rest. You understand what kind of utter destruction that is? It was ugly. Nothing before, nothing since has been of that magnitude. I think that I have been guilty of viewing it too much as just a children's story. It is so much more than that, and there's so much to learn from it. If all that we have is children's storybooks as a reference point for the worldwide flood, we're really missing the point, because not only was it huge, devastating, awful, but there also was a clear lesson and a type for us that we can't miss, that God wanted to teach us and to prepare us. The Ark was not a luxury liner. I know there's some things at the Ark Encounter that make it a bit more modern than Noah's Ark was, but there was no, you think about luxury liners today and ships that you find on the lakes or on the ocean. The luxury liners have flashy lights, they have swimming pools, they have restaurants, and all these things to make your life comfortable. But this ark was built with a very practical purpose in mind, and that was to save the animal kingdom and to save the human race from the outpouring of God's wrath. As I looked at various videos and pictures and just thought about what it was like at that moment when it began to rain and when the fountains of the deep opened up, it was a picture of the wrath of God. I can't hardly put it into words. But this ark was a piece of wood. We looked at the cross in our Sunday school lesson this morning, and I see a lot of similarities. The cross, in a sense, was just a rough piece of wood, but it was created for a very practical purpose, a very meaningful purpose, and it was for the salvation of the human race and for the deliverance of God's people. It wasn't beautiful. The ark is beginning to look a little, the ark encounter is starting to look a little rustic on the outside. The weather is taking its toll on some of that bare wood. And in some ways, it's not that beautiful. And neither was the cross. until you understand the purpose of the cross, the purpose of the ark. And then it makes it beautiful, even though both of them speak of death. They speak of the wrath of God, yet they also speak of deliverance. And they speak of something beautiful as well. Open your Bibles to Genesis chapter 7. Simply named this sermon, Make Thee an Ark, which we find in Genesis 6, chapter 14. I just want to ask four questions that I tried to process as I thought about this whole story, this event. And I want you to think about them with us. Four questions, and hopefully we can find answers for these questions. I want to take the time to do some reading this morning. Let's actually go to Genesis chapter 6. Actually, Genesis chapter 5, the very last verse. And Noah was 500 years old, and Noah begat Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And let's jump ahead to chapter 6, verse 5. And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. Remember what we said last Sunday when we talked about grieving the Holy Spirit? It's hard to put God into human thought. You know, how did God feel? What was God thinking? When we say it repented God and it grieved God, it's not always a parallel to human thought. But I do believe that the grief speaks of love. In order to have grief, there has to be a relationship and a love. So God created man for relationship, created him because he loved him. And when man turned against him, it grieved him at his heart, it says. And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast and the creeping thing and the fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations. And Noah walked with God. And Noah begat three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. And God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt. For all flesh had corrupted his way upon the earth. And God said unto Noah, the end of all flesh is come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them. And behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Make thee an ark of gopher wood. Room shalt thou make in the ark, and shall pitch it within and without with pitch. And this is the fashion which thou shalt make it of. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, the breadth of it 50 cubits, and the height of it 30 cubits. A window shalt thou make to the ark, and in a cubit shalt thou finish it above. And the door of the ark shalt thou set in the side thereof, with lower, second, and third stories shalt thou make it. And behold, I, even I, do bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh, wherein is the breath of life. From under heaven, and everything that is in the earth shall die. But with thee will I establish my covenant, and thou shalt come into the ark, thou and thy sons, and thy wife, and thy sons' wives with thee. And of every living thing of all flesh, two of every sort shalt thou bring into the ark, to keep them alive with thee. They shall be male and female, of fowls after their kind, and of cattle after their kind, of every creeping thing of the earth after his kind, two of every sort shall come unto thee to keep them alive. And thou shalt take thou unto thee of all food that is eaten, and thou shalt gather it to thee, and it shall be for food for thee and for them. Thus did Noah, according to all that God commanded him, so did he. And we'll just stop reading there for now. The first question I want to ask is simply, who was Noah? Who was this man that God called to build this enormous boat, ark? Who was this man that found grace in the eyes of the Lord? Who was this man? Well, what do we know about him? We read that he was a 500-year-old man at the end of chapter 5. in Genesis. But there's a number of qualities. We could look at some of his genealogy. His grandpa was Methuselah, his father was Lamech. But I would particularly look at what the scriptures record about Noah. We see first that he was a just man. We find that in chapter 6, verse 9. Now, these are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man. What does it mean to be a just man? Some translations say a righteous man. And I think probably that word righteous sums up all of what this chapter says about Noah. We also read about him being a preacher of righteousness. We'll see that later. But I would answer that question. Who was Noah? Noah was a righteous man. I know that's a very basic summary. But it says he was just. I assume this refers to his relationship with God and with man. But he goes on to say he was perfect. So first he was just, and then verse 9 says he was perfect in his generations. Perfect. What a testimony. If someone were to summarize your life, would they use the word perfect? What about my life? We think of the word blameless, not in the fact that he was sinless, but there was no blatant faults in his life. He was a man who had determined in his heart that he would serve God, and his life, the fruit of his life, showed that commitment. He was a man of moral integrity among his people. He lived in a land that was completely running away from God, going against God, following the lust of the flesh. But Noah was perfect in his generations. That's an amazing quality. It also says in verse 9 that he walked with God. Noah walked with God. This is how he manifested his righteousness. This is how he lived out the righteousness, is that he walked with God. I don't know. What would you say about a person's life would say this means that they walk with God? Certainly it speaks of relationship, right? It speaks of time spent with God. It speaks of purpose. It speaks of an understanding of God's will for your life. Walking with God, submitting to the pathway that God calls me to walk on, embracing that, loving that. We see later that he was a man of sacrifice. I think that was part of his walk with God. He was a man of worship and sacrifice, a man who understood that he wasn't in this world alone, but he was walking through it with God. We also find several places here, verse 22 of this chapter, it says that he did according to all that God commanded him. So did he. Noah was a man of obedience. That was part of his righteousness as well. He was a man that obeyed God. It also says that in chapter 7, verse 5, and Noah did according to all that the Lord commanded him. Two references that just lay out in detail. No question, he obeyed God. If God said it, then I will do it. Let me just read a verse from Hebrews 11, where it talks about Noah's faith and his obedience. Hebrews 11, 7, by faith Noah, being warned of God of things not yet seen as yet, moved with fear, prepared an ark to the saving of his house, by the which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is by faith. There were so many things that he didn't understand, I'm sure. There were so many things that hadn't been seen. It's hard for us to imagine a world without rain. And maybe this is too silly of an illustration, but imagine if someone said that chocolate pudding was going to be coming out of the sky and flooding your town. We would laugh that off, right? Pudding doesn't come out of the sky, right? Maybe some of you wish that it would. But they hadn't seen rain. Can we wrap our minds around that? God said, I'm going to send rain. Even though Noah never saw it, moved with fear, he obeyed God. Just want to try to impress that on your minds. The priority that Noah put on what God said, God's words, meant something to him, and he obeyed. And then, as we already mentioned, he was a preacher of righteousness. Find that in 2 Peter 2, verse 5. Not only did he live a righteous life, but he was a preacher of righteousness. He spread and proclaimed the need for righteousness, even though he lived in a very ungodly world. These are qualities that God is looking for in us as well. Make thee an ark. And Noah did it. The second question I want to ask is, how did God reward Noah's righteousness? So we said Noah was a righteous man. What was the reward of his righteousness? How did God bless him for his obedience and for his righteous life? I want to read the first five verses of the next chapter, chapter 7. And the Lord said unto Noah, come thou and all thy house into the ark, for thee have I seen righteous before me in this generation. Of every clean beast thou shalt take to thee by sevens, the male and his female, and of beasts that are not clean by two, the male and his female. Of fowls also of the air by sevens, the male and the female, to keep seed alive upon the face of all the earth. For yet 7 days, and I will cause it to rain upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and every living substance that I have made will I destroy from off the face of the earth. And Noah did according to all that the Lord commanded him. Now, here we have God calling Noah into the ark. What was the reward? We tend to view reward this way, I think. If I say that I'm going to reward my children with something, they're probably thinking they're going to get something they like, right? We tend to think of reward as an abundance of something that I really like. That's a reward. I get something that's special to me. We tend to equate, and I suppose this is probably primarily true, the blessing of God with the reward of God. Kind of two different ways of saying the same thing. Now, we have 7 children, and it happens pretty often when we're in public, whether it's shopping or wherever, that someone will comment on our family, because there's not a lot of families that size, you know, meet on a regular basis in town. And I always like to take the opportunity to say, well, I'm very blessed, or these children are a gift from God, or I refer to being blessed by God. So children are a blessing from God. I think that's biblical. Or my dad, those of you who know him, maybe he said it more at home, but one of his phrases, whenever something would happen that was wonderful, he would just say, what a blessing. What a blessing. That's one of the things I'll never forget about Dad. But we tend to equate blessing with something that happens that feels good, or that benefits me, or that is a blessing to me. I'm not sure that that's always fair. Now, we do see, we have this inborn tendency for justice. We are continually processing life on this basis of whether I deserve this or not, okay? And this transfers over into this feeling of, okay, when I get something, when I do something good, I live a good life, I'm a righteous person, then I get an abundance of something that I like. And maybe it's a big family, and maybe it's an early retirement or whatever. Now, what about Noah? What was the reward of his righteousness? Was it wealth? Noah must have been a very wealthy man. I mean, stop and think about it. I'm told that the initial Ark Encounter project in Kentucky was over $100 million. Now, if we decided to build an ark, I don't think any one of you could come up with $100 million. And I don't think that we could, I know we couldn't all pool our resources for $100 million either. So where did Noah come up with the resources to build this ark? I think he was wealthy. He must have been. But stop and think about. So what was that the reward? As soon as the flood was over, Noah had lost all his wealth, right? Any stockpile of cash was now completely useless. The ship, he couldn't sail and make a living with that. What did he have? He had his family. Were his children the reward? If you read through the genealogies in Genesis, I think you'll find most families had more than three children. Noah only had three. Was that his blessing? I think that the reward of Noah's righteousness, and this probably sounds very basic, was simply the fact that he was able to get on the ark. And the fact that he had God. He had God. The reward of righteousness for the Christian is simply being able to get on the ark, finding salvation, and having God, as my own personal friend. That is the greatest reward that we can have for choosing to live a righteous life. Now, we don't earn that. This could so easily get turned around and say, well, we live righteous because God's going to bless us with him. No. But Noah got on the ark, and that was the reward of his faithfulness. That was the ultimate, to be able to find salvation. Suddenly the money is nothing. He had his family, and he had God. It wasn't the people with more money that were getting on the ark. It wasn't the people with more clout. It wasn't the people with more authority in the community. It wasn't the people with more talents. It wasn't the people that were the strongest and the best warriors. No, it was a man named Noah who was righteous, and God rewarded him, not with things, not with stuff, but with himself and with salvation. Now, as a dad, I love coming home from work. Especially the little children. I love when they come running. If I toot the horn when I come in the lane, I almost always have multiple children coming running for a hug. Now, and I'm sure many of you can identify with that. Now, I want to ask this question. If you came home and they all came running, but they waited on their hugs to see if you had brought them something or not, how would that make you feel? Wait, do you have anything for us? No. You see, just having dad, just knowing dad is enough. Of course they like when I bring things home. But just having God, the God of the universe, who cared enough and loved me enough to save me, to provide an ark, to provide a cross, to provide a savior, is enough of a reward. You see, let's not get too sidetracked by, but what about this in my life that's not going the way I wish it would? Is it because I'm not living for God? Is it because I'm not righteous enough? Is it because I'm not just or I'm not obeying God? If we know God, it's enough. If we're saved, that's enough. That is a reward. And will be an ultimate reward when we meet him face to face. Why only eight souls? Question number three. Why was there only eight that made it onto the ark? Let's read verses 6 to 10. And Noah was 600 years old when the flood of waters was upon the earth. And Noah went in, and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him into the ark. There's eight of them there. Because of the waters of the flood, of clean beasts and of fowls that are not clean, and of fowls and of of clean beasts and of beasts that are not clean, and of fowls and of everything that creepeth upon the earth, there went in two and two unto Noah into the ark, the male and the female, as God had commanded Noah. And it came to pass after 7 days that the waters of the flood were upon the earth. Why only eight souls? We read in 1 Peter 3:20 this verse. It says, when once the long-suffering of God waited in the days of Noah, while the ark was a-preparing, wherein few, that is, eight souls, were saved by water. We have Noah at 500 years in chapter 5, and here we have him at 600 years. I know there's been a bit of debate, and I actually was looking at the ark, and I didn't find it. I assume they probably talked about it somewhere, but it was probably 100 or 120 years in building. I know some people say it could have been less than that. I don't know for sure, but it was many, many years. Many years that Noah built this ark, and it says that the long suffering of God waited year after year after year. There was plenty of time for other people to get on the ark. There was plenty of time for Noah to preach a message of salvation. There was plenty of time for people to hear. There was plenty of time, but why only eight? Why only eight? Well, I think the answer to this question is simply that sin is persistent. Year after year, there is something about sin that gets a hold of people. People watched decade after decade, not just week after week or day after day or year after year. It was 10, 20, 30, 40 years people may have watched Noah building that ark. Noah was a preacher. I'm sure many people heard him, but nobody listened. Why? Because sin is so persistent. Sin is so persistent. And we need to remember that as we work with people and as we try to help people and as we try to lead people to the Lord, there is something so persistent about sin that it takes God. It takes God to break a heart. Yes, we should share the gospel. We should preach like Noah. We should warn people. We should pray for people. We should live the gospel. But we don't find Noah with a rope or with handcuffs, forcing people into the ark, do we? He may have wished to. I'm sure there was people in town that he was friends with. There was relatives. He had relatives. Don't you think he wished to just help them in? Just drag them in if that's what it took. No. Sin is persistent, and each man and each woman needs to choose whether or not they're going to give up sin and choose God and to get on the ark. I'm sure Noah thought that maybe somebody will come on. That's why he kept preaching. I'm sure he believed that there was at least an opportunity. But only eight souls accepted the invitation to come onto the ark. The fourth question yet, quickly. Why such a drastic reset, I guess I'll call it. A reset, just back to zero, as it were. Why such a drastic change? Let's finish reading this. Well, maybe we won't for sake of time. The rest of this chapter talks about the drastic reset, talks about the waters prevailing, talks about all the hills being covered, 15 cubits of water above the tallest hills, every living thing that breathed that wasn't on the ark died, and the waters prevailed upon the earth 150 days. Why such a drastic reset? Well, let me give you the answer, and then we'll talk about it. We talked about persistent sin, and I think that the answer is because persistent sin incurs the wrath of God. And persistent sin incurs the wrath of God. We have a display of God's wrath. Now, we don't always like talking about the wrath of God. It's a lot more enjoyable to talk about the love of God. And sometimes maybe we believe that the wrath of God is more of an Old Testament teaching. The wrath of God gets a little uncomfortable, especially when you try to sort out stories like Achan and his family being stoned because of God's wrath, or the person that picked up sticks on the Sabbath day being stoned to death because of God's wrath. Or Korah, Dathan, and Abiram and their families being swallowed up by the earth. Or the disobedient prophet that was killed by a lion because he disobeyed God. The wrath of God poured out on him, swift judgment. But we have it in the New Testament too. We have Ananias and Sapphira. And we struggle with that sometimes. Why was God's wrath poured out so swiftly? But if we go to the end of the Bible and we start reading in Revelation, we see another depiction of the wrath of God being poured out on mankind. Our God is a God of wrath. And this flood, this major upheaval, this drastic reset says something about the wrath of God. We may ask, how could a loving God do something like this? But I think what we should ask is, how can a righteous God not do something like this? You see, without harsh judgment, without stonings in the Old Testament, without those stories, I think we lose our concept and our appreciation for what sin is supposed to cost. How sin looks to Almighty God, to a righteous God, to a just God. This story teaches us something about how awful sin is and how God feels about sin. I think that when we don't view this event properly, when we just see it as a children's story, that we're in danger of not understanding the wrath of God, and consequently not appreciating the mercy of God and the grace of God that Noah found, the redemption of God, the deliverance that God brought. You see, we deserve God's wrath. We have all sinned. We deserve to die because sin incurs the wrath of God, and the wrath of God brings death. But the good news is that God prepared an ark. Even in this awful time, God still loved, and God still cared, and God still desired a relationship with mankind. Why are we here today? Why are we here? It's because God saved 8 people on that ark. If God hadn't, we wouldn't. If he had decided to wipe out mankind, we wouldn't be here. We are a recipient of God's preservation. All the people groups that we see, the animals, we went to the zoo as well on our trip. All of the animals are an indication or a confirmation that God cared enough to preserve, even though he is a God of wrath. He cared about the promise he had made to mankind. He cared about preserving the covenant. And when you understand the ark, and when you understand the wrath and the grace of God in that story, then you begin to understand the cross. You understand the awful death and suffering that Christ took upon himself, accepted, embraced, chose, drank. And you realize that God saved us from his wrath through his son Jesus. He loved us enough. Now, what should this do for us? Let's turn to a few verses yet. 2 Peter chapter 3. Gives us some admonition on what kind of lives we should live as we understand what happened here. 2 Peter 3, verse 11. Seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved, the ark and the flood point forward to a coming destruction. Seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought ye to be in all holy conversation and godliness, looking for and hasting unto the coming of the day of God, wherein the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth, wherein dwelleth righteousness. Wherefore, beloved, seeing that ye look for such things, be diligent that ye may be found of him in peace, without spot and blameless. Does that sound like Noah? Without spot and blameless. That is what God calls us to. Let me read yet from Matthew 24. You don't need to turn there. You can just listen. But of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered into the ark, and knew not until the flood came and took them all away. So shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. There shall two be in the field. The one shall be taken and the other left. Two women shall be grinding at the mill. The one shall be taken and the other left. Watch, therefore, for ye know not what hour your Lord doth come. The ark serves as a reminder of a day that's coming. Just as in Noah's day, one day the door was shut and the rain began. And only those who were prepared ahead of that day were able to find salvation. God, help us to look honestly at our hearts, to live righteously, to have a relationship with Him so that we can be inside the ark on that day. Let's kneel for prayer.